listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television via Free Speech TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. So pleased to be with you, and so pleased to have with us America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, attorney with Levin Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. Hey, Pap, how you doing?
How are you, Tom?
I'm well. It's always great having you on. So, wild stuff going down there in Florida. I don't understand how Rick Scott can even be competitive, given this guy's history. Is it that the newspapers aren't covering it?
Well, they've covered it, but they haven't covered the story behind the story. When they talk about the fact that Rick Scott committed serious fraud, Medicaid fraud, TRICARE fraud, Medicaid fraud, and that he had to plead the Fifth Amendment 75 times so he wouldn't go to prison, that's only the top of the story. The story is, what did he do? And what he did was, if a person would show up at the HCA clinic, they would take a sprained hand, and then they would upcoat it to where it looked like a broken arm. So all of a sudden, the billing goes from a sprained hand to a broken arm. And so that's how he made money. He would do, the organization would do laminectomies that weren't required. They would do CT scans that 10 other doctors would say, there's no need for a CT scan. They simply drained Medicaid, TRICARE, Medicare as much as they could. And the number's probably closer to $3 billion. But they only got fined for $1.7 billion.
Wow.
And so people don't understand what it means to commit this caliber of fraud. They made stuff up, Tom. You would have a patient show up with, I'm here for just a checkup. And before they left, that patient was having migraine headaches and suspected of having a brain tumor, that type of thing. And so that's it. But nevertheless, the story's out there, but the media's done a very poor story, very poor job explaining it.
Yeah. Your thoughts on Charlie Crist as a candidate?
Well, I think right now it's a dead heat. I mean, it's anybody's call right now. The more we're seeing of Rick Scott right now, the more we're asking. Finally, the Florida voters are asking some serious questions. You know, when Governor Scott cornered Rick Scott on his death penalty stands, what we're starting to see is this pattern. We saw Rick Scott respond, first of all, trying to ignore it, and then looking like a deer in headlights. He gave that same look that you see 75 times in the depositions that he gave, where he's trying to stay out of prison. But it's kind of that thousand-yard stare. It's the blinking, it's the stammering, it's the stuttering, because he simply knows that he's caught. And that's the brand that Rick Scott has right now. So what the media is trying to do, or what his camp is trying to do, is keep him out of the media. They don't want him in front of cameras. This was the last debate. You know, they feel relieved by that. So relieved that Rick Scott has put $22 million of his own money into the race. And he's hoping that he can stay out there without physically being out there, because he is such an oddball. I mean, he has this down here. They call it the geek factor, the creep factor. When you look at him, women just run from him. I mean, his women vote down here is he's in really bad shape because of what he projects. And it's odd to have a candidate like that that won the first time to begin with. But Charlie Crist is a pretty competitive character, but it's a tough race.
Yeah, I had Charlie Crist on the show, I don't know, maybe 2 months ago or so. He was live here in the studio with us, and I was very impressed by him. He came across as one of the adults in the room.
Yeah, well, he actually cares about people, and Rick Scott cares about his billionaire pals that are propping up his campaign. And one thing we need to know about Rick Scott, for example, is we need to know what his financials are. He won't release his financials. Won't do it. And he says he can't do it because all of his millions are in his wife's blind trust. Well, the reason they want to see this, voters want to see it, is because he's giving all these sweetheart deals to driller, offshore drillers. He's giving all these sweetheart deals to frackers that are destroying, potentially going to obliterate, the Okeechobee, that whole area around Okeechobee. Yeah. And so we want to know, or the prisons, you know, what's his financial interest in privatizing prisons or privatizing school? And we know that there's something going on. Everybody knows it. But he's been able to hide his financials, so we can't find out. In the media, again, you know, so what? You know, 25 years ago, that would have been the thing that everybody was talking about. How dare you hide your financials and say that your money's in a blind trust and you can't let us know how much money you're spending on things like oil research, you know, exploration or, you know, the prison system or education. We have a right to know that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this is another demonstration, I think, of the way that Republicans win, or at least the Republican strategy for their path to winning, is either by deflecting people's attention from real issues with bright, shiny things. You know, somebody made a gaffe. Alison London Grimes won't say that she voted for Obama. Oh, my God, let's turn that into the, you know, that's what the race is going to turn on. Either A or B, actually preventing people from voting. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg was quite outspoken about this Friday night, Saturday.
Well, yeah. The Supreme Court, it's a disaster what we're seeing with the Supreme Court. You know, several years ago, 4 years ago, we might have been reasonable to believe that the SCOTUS majority of Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Kennedy, that we suspected they were Republican hacks. But we might have thought there was some reasonable, plausible reason for them to come forward with the judicial methodology that they were coming forward with. There was some precedent. And we might have thought, well, maybe they're trying to do the right thing. Today, you'd have to be mentally challenged not to see that this SCOTUS majority is simply there to protect dead, dying, gray, feeble remnants of a struggling Republican Party. I mean, the white sheets have come off their head. I mean, that's just the truth.
Yeah.
We see no talent, no character for these majority party hacks. And we know what they are. They're there to deliver for Republican bosses. The facts speak for themselves. You have 15 states, for the first time, 15 new states in 2014 that face brand new restrictions for the first time in midterm elections, completely designed to make the act of voting difficult for blacks, Hispanics, disabled, elderly, things like this. You can't vote at this poll place because if you do, your vote will be completely nullified. You might be carrying a military ID, but that's not enough. You need a special ID that comes from us or you can't vote. So you have thousands, tens of thousands of people that are registered to vote. They've been voting for years with the same registration. They might be military, active military, and they're being told, gee, you can't vote because you don't have that special card. In Texas, as you know, the Fifth Circuit determined that it was just fine to tell 600,000 registered voters that they couldn't vote because they didn't have this new improved voter ID card.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, if Democrats had prevented veterans from voting, the Republicans would be screaming about this. Why are the Democrats not jumping down Rick Perry's throat for saying that a military ID isn't good enough for voting, but a gun license is?
Tom, they don't have a backbone.
Oh, yeah.
They don't. I mean, I've said it before. The Democratic Party is in shambles. They simply don't have a backbone. They don't know how to deliver a message. And when they try to deliver a message, they usually screw that up. They can have all this great material to deliver, but leadership is awful. From Obama's office all the way down to the triple DC running these state elections. They are awful. And for some reason, we won't admit that they're awful. We let them perpetuate.
We need to get some better people in there. America's lawyer, Mike Papatoni. Thanks, Pat, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can check out Pap's website, Mike Papatonia's website, at ringoffireradio.com. And welcome back. Pap, you still with us?
I am.
So what's going on with Ring of Fire TV this weekend?
Well, we're going to spend some time talking about Michael Wiener Savage. You know, he's the guy that has never picked up a gun to defend this country in his life. But he is now criticizing soldiers coming home that are injured, and he's calling them whiny babies, that they're boo-boo whiny babies. This is a guy that you know he's gone through life having the hell beat out of him because his name has been Michael Wiener all his life. And so all of a sudden he changes his name to Michael Savage and becomes this tough guy. If you remember, this is the guy who said that autism is completely a racket that's being used by poor people to be able to take advantage of taxpayers and welfare. He's the guy that said we should burn the Quran. This character is the ugliest of uglies. And understand this, he was on MSNBC, for God's sakes. Was on MSNBC until he got into a discussion with somebody who was just joking with him. He said, and he calls him a sodomite. He said, I hope you get AIDS and die, you pig. Go eat a sausage and choke. I mean, just crazy talk. But nevertheless, advertisers still advertise them. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to talk, Howard Nations is going to be here to talk about Hank Greenberg's suit against the government. How ridiculous it is, how taxpayers have already paid $185 billion, and old Hank wants more. Tom Crosley is going to explain the link between fracking and the Eagle Ford shale, the massive uptick in huge traffic accidents, biggest in the country where they're fracking. Michael Berg's going to tell us how construction defect contractors use fraud and how they beat down the owners of property to never get paid back for all the fraud that they commit. Peter Mouget is going to talk about the Fed tapes that were released about Goldman Sachs and explain how ugly Wall Street's really become. And then Adele Stan, senior digital editor of the American Prospect, is going to explain how Rand Paul's hoping to make over the GOP in his own image. That's very scary.
Yeah, that is very scary. Adele is great, by the way. Be sure to tell her I said hi. She is really good.
She's very talented.
How does fracking lead to an increase in car accidents? Is it because of the big oil drilling trucks rip up the roads?
Well, what's happening, you have just hundreds of trucks with drivers. They're just bringing drivers in from everywhere that aren't qualified simply so they can deliver all this stuff. The trucks are destroying the roads. I mean, there's no more paved roads in most of the places where these trucks have gone. And so taxpayers don't have the money to fix those roads. But the biggest thing is they have tripled the traffic, and the number of fatalities have increased somewhere around 55% in these high concentration fracking areas. I thought one statistic, there's something like 70% higher than the rest of the nation where it comes to per capita kind of fatalities. But it's just a matter of the fracking companies trying to cut corners so they don't do the inspections on the truck. They don't hire drivers that are qualified. They make drivers drive triple the time they're supposed to. So these guys are on amphetamines driving up and down the highways there in Texas, killing people by the hundreds, literally.
That's insane. That's insane. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer, is an attorney with Levin Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, and right here on Free Speech TV, Ring of Fire TV every Sunday at noon. And it plays throughout the week as well. Ringofireradio.com, the website. Pap, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And for the great work that you do in the media. Thank you. We'll be back 20 minutes past. You believe Michael Wiener going off, Michael Savage going off on a vat with PTSD yesterday? I mean, I'm
so sick and tired of everything.
Well, actually, you've got a clip of it, don't you? Yeah. Okay, here it is.
I am so sick and tired of everyone with their complaints about PTSD, depression. Everyone wants their hand held in a check, a government check. What, are you the only generation that PTSD? The only generation that's depressed? I'm sick of it. I can't take the celebration of weakness and depression. See, I was raised a little differently. I was raised to fight weakness. I was raised to fight pain. I was raised to fight depression, not to give into it, not to cave into it and cry like a little baby in bed. Boo-hoo-hoo. Boo-hoo-hoo. Everyone has depression in their life. Everyone has sickness and sadness and disease and loss of relatives and loss of career. Everyone has depression in their life.
Okay, let's just stop this.
But if the whole nation
right
is told boo,
I don't want to go beyond fair use. First of all, but secondly, I think you get the point. And you know, it's there's an absolute limit to what I can handle. There's an argument to be had here. I mean, there's a lot of conversation, you know, and has been for the past 20 years or so, I guess, about helicopter parenting and every child wins a prize and you know, all, you know, criticizing basically the suffocation of kids growing up, you know, with over affection and over help and all that kind of thing. And then on the, you know, the flip side of that, you got that woman who wrote that book, Tiger Mom, a year or two ago, you know, about just, you know, be tough on them and, you know, whip them into shape. And then the flip side of that came out. Well, yeah, some of these kids are incredibly high achievers and very wounded, but they're high achievers. But does anybody get out of life not wounded? And then, you know, and so it just kind of goes in circles. But to suggest that a vet, that somebody who was lied to by George W. Bush and went off and joined the military, a very large life-changing act, believing that they were doing the right thing, and then they find themselves in a country that doesn't want us, that didn't offend us, that represented no threat to us, killing people that they don't know for reasons that they can't explain, and seeing their friends die so that George W. Bush could get himself reelected. I mean, that's basically the whole thing of Iraq. Back in 1999, George W. Bush told Mickey Herskowitz, his biographer, when he was writing the Charge to Keep, Bush's autobiography, the ghostwriter, Mickey Herskowitz, Bush told him that, you know, if he became president, he wasn't going to make the mistake that his daddy made of only having a 100-hour-long war. You know, George Sr. didn't get reelected on the first Gulf War because it didn't run long enough. It didn't run all the way up into the election cycle. He didn't get to be a war president during an election year. And George W. said, I'm not going to make that mistake. My father had all his political capitals, you know, and he blew it. He says, if I have a chance to invade Iraq, if I become president, keep in mind, this is 1999. This is before he even declared his campaign for president. So if I get to be president, I'm going to be a successful war president. We're going to have a real war. And then we'll use that political capital to privatize Social Security, which is what he, back in 1979, what he had run for, or the 78 election, I guess it was, in Texas. He ran for the House of Representatives unsuccessfully. George W. lost the race. And what he was running on was privatizing Social Security, which is what, in 2005, after the election, he said, I got political capital, now I'm going to use it, from being a war president. So you get these kids who go over there and just, their lives are shattered. And they come back to the United States and there's no job, there's no recognition of the sacrifice that they've made. You know, it might not have been in the service of a good cause, but it was a sacrifice. And then they get these right-wing commentators on hard right-wing radio literally making fun of them, ridiculing them. People who said, yes, I will put my life on the line. I'm willing to come back with, you know, missing a leg, missing an eye. I'm willing to die for my country, right or wrong. And they come back to this country wounded and damaged, and some you know, crazy right winger goes off on how they're pathetic. Really? So yeah, I think that, you know, it is a useful thing for all of us to say, you know, we would like to rise above adversity, and you know, we want our kids to be resilient, we want our society and our culture to be resilient, we want ourselves to be resilient. There's a lot of good ways to build resilience, but ridiculing people is not one of them. Anyhow, in the next hour, by the way, we're going to have one of the city councilmen on from South Florida City, South Miami, that wants to secede from Florida. It's that bad. Rick Scott is that bad.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, it's really, really pretty amazing. And Sam Brownback, what he is up to in Kansas, he's destroyed the state with Reaganomics. In just 4 years, he's destroyed his state. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Pete said a couple of people called to ask if I was a vet or I was speaking on behalf of vets. I'm neither. I'm not a vet, and I'm not speaking on behalf of vets. Michael Savage is also not a vet, to the best of my knowledge. But I don't think you have to be a vet to realize that people come back from war with real wounds. I certainly have my share of friends who came back from, in my case, mostly the war in Vietnam, with real wounds, and a couple who didn't come back at all. So, anyway, enough on that. I wanted to get into the Brownback stuff. Jody Ernst, she gave this speech to the NRA about how she carries a Smith & Wesson 9mm with her in case the government wants to take away her freedoms. What was the woman who ran against Harry Reid? What was her name? The crazy lady? Sharon Angle, that's right, who ran against Harry Reid and was like I'm pretty sure she was the one who was talking about Second Amendment solutions, right? To say, oh, God, save us from these people. Anyway, Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, you wanted to weigh in on the plight of veterans.
You know that,
that's right.
But, yeah, before that, that's kind of funny about Joni Ernst saying that, because isn't she running for a job with said government that would, quote-unquote, take her freedoms?
That's correct, yeah. She wants to be a United States senator. Well, I mean, this all got started by a guy who ran for president on the platform of, you know, we hate the president, we hate the government, we don't, you know, although he actually didn't act that way, but he talked that way. And now now you got people like Sam Brownback trying to act that way, and it doesn't work.
Yeah. But, you know, regarding Michael Savage, We really ought to thank him because he's finally revealing what the right wing really thinks about veterans.
Yeah.
Support the troops, sure, but not once they become veterans. I mean, that's why the VA was cut to the bone during Shrub's reign of error. That's trademarked for what I call the Bush administration.
Yeah.
Shrub's reign of error.
That's a good one.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, none of these right-wing pundits that are, like, really, really gung-ho about war. And when you're talking about Savage, you're talking about a guy who was in favor of bringing back the Alien and Sedition Acts, of course, during Shrub's reign of error.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. That's pretty amazing. Hack, thank you. Interesting point. Maybe we should thank Michael. Donald in Chicago, you wanted to weigh in on this?
Hello?
Hey, Donald.
Well, that's okay. I'll go with Donald.
Oh, is that not your name? I'm sorry.
No, but that'll work.
Well, we need to correct our database then.
Mike. Well, Mike. So.
You're Mike.
Yeah.
Okay. All
I don't
right.
even know if you're
ask Pete to fix that
for my name, but be that as it may.
That's okay. Michael, what's up? Mike, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, regarding Savage's comment, it was spoken like a true chicken hawk, you know?
Mm.
And this guy, you know, for somebody who can't tolerate people who complain, if you've ever listened to his show for any length of time, you'll hear him constantly complain about the fact that he was cheated during his scholastic years at, I think it was Berkeley, due to... affirmative action.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah, he constantly complains about that.
Wow.
So,
that's
yeah,
scary stuff. I used to actually listen to Michael Savage's show a fair amount. Back when we lived in Portland, we would, after I got off the air, his show would come on the air on the local station, and Louise and I would drive out to Oregon City or something to get some lunch and listen. I think he's a very good entertainer. He's a good performer, and
yeah.
He's a good talk show host. I totally disagree with his politics.
Oh, certainly. But, you know, I'm sure you probably heard him mention that. I don't think you could have listened to him for any length of time without that. You know, he, I think he's put himself now on a level with Fred Phelps with his with these comments.
Yeah, that's kind of sad, but basically becoming a cartoon character. I don't disagree. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
I hope you keep talking about. I hope you keep playing those tapes. I really do.
Well, I'm not on a one man anti Michael Savage campaign here. I think what it does is it illustrates the larger point, like you said, the basic cruelty of the right. Last night on the TV show, I was debating Kevin and Chris, and they were supporting John Kasich's position in Ohio that people should work 20 hours a week, either trying to find a job or volunteering, like picking up trash on the roadside and that kind of thing, in exchange for getting food stamps. Food stamps are like $2 a day, right? Maybe $3 a day, but let's say it's $2 a day worth of food stamps that you get, and they want somebody to work 20 hours a week. There's 5 days a week. That's 4 hours a day. So in exchange for $2 worth of food stamps, they want you to work 4 hours, which is 50 cents an hour, if I'm doing my math right. And this is what John Kasich thinks is right, and this is what, you know, this is what the people I was debating think. There's just a fundamental brutality to the right, and I think, you know, Michael Savage has done a good job of pointing that out. Donald, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Michael in Temecula, California. Hey, Michael.
How you doing?
Good. Okay. Veterans?
I come in. Temecula, California, yes. I'm a veteran, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A couple of things. One of the things that I noticed when I first retired from the military was it's difficult to actually get a job for the veterans department because I went and applied and never even got a look-see.
Yeah.
So they're not really veteran-friendly like they say. Part two of that is people from the right wing talk about bravery, but have you noticed that everybody needs a gun? Brave men don't need guns, and that's all I had to say about it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And by the way, what's with Rick Perry in Texas, and the Fifth Circuit Court upheld this, that if you have a gun concealed carry permit, you can vote. But if you have military ID, veterans ID, you can't vote. That's not adequate to prove that you are worthy of voting in the state of Texas. You know, what's with Rick Perry's war and Greg Abbott's war on veterans? I don't get that either. Anyhow.
Are you speaking to me?
Yeah, well, I'm speaking, I guess, in random.
Well, you look at that because, there, again, in order to get in the military, you do show a birth certificate from your state and everything else. So they know that if you got in there, you had to prove you were you.
Right.
And it's just them playing.
Yeah, what I'm thinking, the reason I'm guessing that Rick Perry and the Republicans in Texas don't want veterans to be able to vote or actually have passed a law saying that a veteran's ID is not adequate to prove that you are who you say you are, when even if you're already a registered voter in Texas. The reason why is because whereas concealed carry permit holders in Texas are probably overwhelmingly white, the military is fairly well integrated. And so you're going to get veterans of all races, and Republicans are not down with that at all. So, I don't know, my theory, maybe I'm being overly paranoid here.
No, I think you're being just paranoid enough.
Yeah, okay. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. David in Zion, Illinois. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, long-time listener, first-time caller. Every day is an education with you. It's a fantastic job you're doing.
Thank you.
No, I just wanted to run an idea past you. Commentators like Mike Savage, Mr. Savage, which I don't even think is his real name.
No, his real name is Wiener.
That might be Wiener. Yeah, that's a little mockable. but it's, commentators like him, Rush Limbaugh, Ann Coulter, Sean Hannity, it really does seem like they have, excuse me, they have to say more and more outrageous things. They have to keep topping themselves, just like so that they stay relevant, so they stay in the limelight.
Could be. I, you know, I think Michael Savage is doing fairly well in the radio business, and he's got pretty good ratings. So, I doubt this is a stunt. I think that what you're hearing here is just, you know, unadulterated, you know, not just Michael Savage, but also a worldview that is shared by many people, or he wouldn't have as many listeners as he does, and the kind of support he does. David, thanks for the call. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John. Democrats?
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in on voter ID. You know, I think the leadership from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is what I would like to see, you know, throughout the Democratic Party. I think the Democratic Party, you know, it dabbles in the polls. You know, they're afraid to be seen with President Obama. You know, they do lack a spine, and I have to agree with Mike Papantonio that, you know, they, like, for instance, in this state, the DFL, which is what the Democratic Party is called, weren't even going to take up the issue until Keith Ellison made it an issue. And you know what? We won.
What issue?
And that was really good. And I think that...
What issue are you talking about that they weren't going to take up?
They were not going to take up the issue of voter ID because they thought it was complicated for, you know, I mean, and it was really an insult to people's intelligence that they could, could figure that out. Right. We have one of the most liberal voting processes in the country. It's just on the basis of your signature, and you can register to vote at the poll, you know, that day. And they've been doing that for since Minnesota has been a state. And yet, you know, there were people like Michelle Bachmann, because we really are a purple state, so you have these two poles, you know, and she's making it an issue in her people. And, you know, the DFL wouldn't take them on, and they're undercutting their own power base. Yeah. I mean,
I agree with you, and I think that these Democrats who have been running away from President Obama are making a big mistake, too. I think that you need to have the courage of your convictions. John, thank you for the call. Most Democrats do, and particularly with regard to issues, but they're listening way too much to their political consultants.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Bob Schrum helped, what, 4 Democrats lose their elections? I mean, you know, it's at some point you say to the consultants, get out of the way. I'm just going to be me. And welcome back. Larry, watching Free Speech TV in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for everything you do. I'm here in Tucson, Arizona, and as you may know, the Phoenix Veterans Hospital was one of the ones that kicked off the investigation into how poorly we're responding to our injured and ill veterans.
Right.
And I wasn't in the vet. I mean, I'm a peacetime vet, and mm-hmm. I hadn't used the Veterans Administration until I had some personal difficulties that were physical as well as emotional, and I saw just how terribly our government is willing to respond to the people who voluntarily said, I will stand between you and whatever bullets you demand,
mm-hmm.
and I will follow your orders to protect my country, right or wrong, as you've said before. Now, active duty military are killing themselves one every 18 hours, and the veterans, I think, is maybe a higher rate.
It is a higher rate.
And we have hundreds of thousands of returning veterans with psychological and emotional challenges, and, as others have mentioned, challenges for employment. Mm-hmm. Now, I have what I think is a reasonable solution, and oftentimes you've said the government should be the employer of last resort. And I believe that somewhere in the government, whether it's the Veterans Administration or Housing and Urban Development or a collection of whatever, we need to find the funding to hire these vets. And one of the great ways we can do this here in Arizona, rurally, 1 in 3 children doesn't know where their next meal is coming from. And I think we have a serious difficulty in America feeding our children healthy, safe food and locally grown, because with the climate change is coming, we're going to be evacuating the seashores, we're going to be evacuating a lot of fields that used to feed people. We need locally grown stuff. So instead of closing the military base here in Tucson or continuing to pollute our skies with A-10s, I'm trying to convince Congressman Barber that what we need to do is take government property that we already have and start a pilot program. Out here in Arizona, we have some really fine indoor gardening strategies. We have the biosphere. We also have great outdoor strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And by feeding the hungry veterans, the veterans in hospital, providing training for this new modern gardening technique that's called sustainable, where we create our own power and we create topsoil and we feed the local hungry children. We feed all the vets in hospital, and we have a disproportionate number of vets out here in the West where it's sunny and semi-cheap to live. So we have a large base, but I've been in the military in the training section, and I've seen we can train these people to do anything from tighten bolts to maintain incredible weapon systems that are super high tech. So I know we can accomplish every task in sustainable indoor and outdoor gardening.
I agree. It just takes the political will to make it happen. And that's where we need to be pushing our politicians. You're absolutely right, Larry. We need to be pushing our politicians, and thank you for the call. And ourselves. I mean, we need to be pushing the message out. You've got a great one. Thank you very much for the call. 10 minutes before the end. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Just a couple blocks from the Supreme Court building in the nation's capital. And here in the beautiful city of Washington, D.C., the District of the Goddess. Donald in Chicago, Illinois. I think this time we got the right Donald.
Yes, hi. How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I want to mention that I'm both a senior citizen and a veteran. I was drafted in 66, got out in 68, and absolutely furious at what this Michael Savage said. Now, the thing is this. What really kills me about this whole thing, they view the veterans like they do the pro-lifers do. Once the kids are born into the world, they don't give a damn about them. Same thing with the, I believe you even mentioned, once they become veterans, they don't care about us anyway. They don't care about us either. But what really gets me is 58% of my fellow veterans voted for Republicans.
Yeah.
And not only that, there too, you got these kids, I don't know how many veterans that are involved in these conflicts now, but I wonder, there's probably quite a few of them that voted Republican. So while they're pledging their allegiance to the flag, you got the very people that they put in the power pledging their allegiance to the likes of Grover Norquist, Sheldon Adelson, and Karl Rove, and only wanted support the corporations and the millionaires and billionaires. That's all I got to say. Oh,
yeah.
One more thing. I think the senior citizens better wake up, too, because from what I understand, once the Republicans get in, they want to bring back chain CPI.
Yeah, they want to go beyond that. They want to privatize Social Security full bore. You got Pete Peterson out there spending millions on this thing, and Simpson and Bowles and whatnot, all these others. It's going to get bad. Donald, thank you very much for the call. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, how you doing?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a revelation here after November 5th. These polls are all skewed. And the reason being is most families now have cell phones instead of home phones. And when your phone rings, you look at it to see who's calling. If you don't know who's calling, 9 times out of 10, they just hang up.
Yeah.
So how you get in a adequate poll?
This is one of the problems that has evolved for pollsters over the last decade and a half or so. In a big way, is that, cell phones, there's no phone book for cell phones. It's why occasionally you will get calls from 800 numbers, and if you answer it, there won't be anybody there. The 800 numbers track or grab your information. They can't track you around, but they collect your information. And if you answer, then they know that that's a phone number that works, and they're just, serious calling, thousands of people just to build a database of phone numbers that they can then sell. And you can buy these databases of phone numbers, of cell phone numbers. And so now, whereas, 5-10 years ago, it was a lot harder for them to get good databases of phone numbers. They're actually finding, they're buying, you can buy them from places like, Amazon customers. I don't know if Amazon specifically sells theirs, but many large retailers sell their customer lists, which includes their phone numbers, which includes all those cell numbers. So increasingly, Corky, our cell numbers are available to pollsters, and it's not quite as simple as what you described. And I think that they, by and large, are actually calibrating their polls to consider those things. That said, and the evidence of that is, 2 years ago, by and large, the polls and the election results were not that dissimilar. But that said, I think that there's also, let's not despair in the face of bad polls, and let's not celebrate in the face of good ones. We still have to get people up and out to vote. This is a big election coming up. It's a big deal. Corky, thanks for the call. Mark in Waterville, Maine. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about population explosion that you were talking about yesterday as it relates to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, most Republicans, basically every stance just contradicts with another one. Like, they just say one thing, but it really contradicts with another stance of theirs.
Well, consistency is not their thing necessarily, or at least a commitment to truth and principle. Other than the principle of if the billionaires benefit from it, it's good. If the transnational corporations benefit from it, it's good. If working people benefit from it, it's bad. That's
exactly.
Or poor people. I used
to be a Republican because I'm fiscally conservative, but like 99% of people socially liberal. Yeah. And the point I was trying to make is there's a lot of people out there that, especially I'm calling from Maine, like your last caller was calling from Arizona. Yeah. It's a totally different story, view on climate change. And a lot of Republicans that are may not believe in global warming. I mean, it's true it's caused by carbon emissions.
Yeah.
But ice ages are also caused by other things that man has no control over. So for those that are sort of like fence jumpers or kind of on the line, for Republicans or Democrats, do your own research. The good thing is, like, Maine particularly is 3 degrees below normal this year. So, like, in an ice age or a global cooling kind of phase, agriculture's hurt far more than in a global warming. But for those that might support the Republicans because they don't support the green agenda, so to speak, are actually just hurting themselves because of the green agenda can actually help curb the population explosion in the Middle East by getting us off fossil fuels.
Yeah, yeah.
And as far as research, you know, like 97% of scientists support that we are still in the warming phase, and 3% don't. Well, of course, all the other 3%, they definitely work for the oil companies. A good majority of the 97% are paid by governments to research the need for the existence of their job.
Or universities.
Right. But even, say, somebody like me who believes that, you know, the warming phase ended in 2010, we're kind of going into a cooling phase, at least under Democrats, they're pro-science and have scientists on staff.
Yeah.
And that's more important than really anything else, because we need to be prepared for any climate change, not just warming.
Yeah.
And just, it's just insane to vote for an anti-science party, which basically the Republican Party is right now.
Yeah, and
completely anti-science.
Yeah, and has been for a while. I agree with you. I disagree with you that we're in a cooling phase. What we're seeing, I believe, is that because the Arctic is warming 6 times faster than the mid-latitudes, the temperature gradient, the temperature differential between the Arctic air and the temperate air over Central North America. That temperature gradient used to produce a wall of air that kept the jet stream in place. That wall is disintegrating now because the gradient is collapsing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, when Reagan suggested that Lafler, and perhaps, you know, it's a perfectly appropriate name, we should laugh at it, but that Lafler's curve was, you know, something solid that we should be considering, Reagan didn't actually buy that. Well, maybe he did, but the people around him, David Stockman has now come out, you know, he's written his book and he's been on this program. Yeah, we knew that it wasn't going to work. I'm going to get back to that in just a minute. I want to get back to what Sam Brownback is up to. But first, Walter Harris is with us. He's a commissioner and the vice mayor of South Miami, Florida. SouthMiamiFL.gov is their website. And Commissioner Harris, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak with you.
And thanks for joining us. I understand that your town has just held a vote on. Well, tell us about it.
Well, in a nutshell, South Florida feels the time is appropriate and propitious and necessary to make a statement, to make a move to create a 51st state called South Florida. For the last 6 years, this has been an issue between North and South Florida, South Florida being urban, North Florida being rural, South Florida being liberal, North Florida being conservative. But South Florida basically paying almost 70% of the revenue for the state with about 67% of the population. And we were not getting the representation from Tallahassee that we needed. This has always been an issue. But this is just money and politics. Mm-hmm. But now things have changed dramatically with climate change, global warming, and rising sea levels.
Yeah, you got
South Florida. I'm sorry, go if you want to interrupt me.
No, no.
I don't know what to say.
Apropos of that, I've seen reports that in Miami and the area around Miami, and maybe it's your town, South Miami, you're actually now starting to see the water hitting buildings.
Absolutely. When you get the super high tides on Miami Beach, there's all sorts of problems. Fort Lauderdale, North Fort Lauderdale Beach has basically had permanent damage. It's rising much faster than anyone thought 5 years ago would be rising.
Yeah.
And it's rising, basically, I believe, that it's supposed to rise between 3 and 4 feet by the end of this century.
Yeah.
And South Florida itself, basically, it's less than 5 feet above sea level. The whole South Florida state area would be less than 50 feet, but all the coastal areas are all throughout the state and all throughout the United States and all throughout the world. But South Florida itself is a very, very unique environmental situation. We have the whole area is built on top of limestone rock, which is porous, and water can actually up through it. So as the rising sea levels go, needless to say, we're going to have less ground under our feet on top of everything else.
Yeah.
But the real problem is it's happening so much faster. Miami Beach, for instance, just spent $200 million to set up a series of pumps to clear off all the main streets so cars can get through. So the last super high tide of about 2 weeks ago, they tried out the pumps for the first time, and the street flooded for a while, but then they pumped it out, and it was great. Of course, they pumped it into Biscayne Bay. We don't even come close to yet thinking of what those ramifications are going to be, pumping every bit of refuse into the bay. But right now, this is their first step. This area is being watched. The whole South Florida area is being watched very closely by the rest of the world. They had a conference there. People came from all over the world. Because what happens to us will ultimately happen to them. We are much lower than most areas and built on limestone rock, which makes life even more complex.
Right.
So, to make a long story short, the main issue is we really need to be in control of our own situation without having to go through the bureaucratic nonsense in Tallahassee. And it's been going on a long time, but now it's very urgent.
Yeah.
Now it's unprecedented what's happening, and happening so much faster than anyone could have imagined.
So what's
I'm sorry, go on.
No, yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I can just bant Ron, which I don't particularly want to do. But,
well, we have three more minutes. But I did have a specific question. You have voted to secede to, or not actually secede from the union, but to secede from Florida, separate yourself from the rest of Florida.
State, yeah.
Yeah. And create the 51st state. What's the next step? I mean, politically, was this just a gesture, or have you actually initiated a process that's going to end at some point?
Well, the initial reaction to the people that heard about it, I hadn't told anybody I was going to do it until I actually did it. I'd been doing research for a few weeks, sort of inspired by Scotland. But the fact is, It's an uphill fight. We ultimately, first we'll have to get an organization together to get the word out, to let people know why we're doing this. Then we have to get a petition, and then we get the item on the ballot. And then we have to get the United States Congress to say, hey, we agree with you. And everybody says that's the obstacle. The United States government is not going to do, you know, they're not going to allow a state separation. Well, these are unprecedented times. And these, you know, the last time they did this, I think, was during the Civil War. And but these conditions now are unquestionable. They're not going to get better. They're only going to get worse. It's a total reality. And I believe it can be done. And so I'm continuing this, even though, you know, certain people said not to, or they said to continue it just to let Tallahassee know we're not playing games anymore. But I believe, no, I did it because I believe the time is right and it had to start somewhere. That was my thinking. It had to start somewhere. So
I agree with you. And I think that also, I mean, we have relatively proportional representation, setting aside the gerrymandering issue, in the House of Representatives, but very much not in the Senate. A senator from Oklahoma's vote or Wyoming's vote has, you know, 30 times more impact than the senator from California's vote on a per-person basis.
Yeah, exactly.
I've long suggested that California should be broken into three states, Texas should be broken into two states, Florida and New York should both be broken into two states, New York City should separate, South Florida should separate. And if we did those things, you would have a Senate that would be much more representative of the United States because each new state gets two senators. So
I will be quoting you on that.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yes, I am. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But now every part of all the coastal states are going to be experiencing some serious problems.
Yeah.
And and New York City, whoa. So this is the time for those to be taken into account. Things have changed now. So the United States will probably have to change with them.
I suspect so. You know, I suspect so. Reality has a way of slapping us in the face. Commissioner Walter Harris, Vice Mayor of South Miami, Florida. SouthMiamiFL.gov is the website. Voting to secede from Florida and create a 51st state, South Florida. Marvelous idea and a great conversation. Commissioner Harris, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Great talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And what do you think? Should we start this? You know, let's start breaking up the states. I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. And welcome back. Bruce in Buffalo, New York, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Bruce, what's on your mind today?
Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
I think the Democrats are doing a terrible job in branding themselves.
I agree.
I have a suggestion that may be very feeble, and maybe they can use it. I don't know. But anyway, Rachel Maddow uses PowerPoint, and she showed, for instance, this what she called the bikini curve.
Yeah.
How the unemployment rate started decreasing as when Obama took office. And I think that the Democrats and anybody opposed to the Republican brand could use PowerPoint much more successfully than they are now. People tend to remember things when they see them and hear them.
Mm-hmm.
If they just hear them, it kind of floats off, you know. But when they see a visual representation, for instance, taking Obamacare. Now, if they showed the number of people that are getting health coverage that weren't getting it before, the number of young adults up to age 26 that are now using their parents' care, and if they made charts and graphs of these sorts of things, people would visualize these things, and they'd say, hey, maybe these Democrats have something that's worth looking at.
The other thing is that the voices of low-income workers, and poor people and disabled people in the United States are basically don't exist in our mainstream dialogues. You know, it's
true.
It's you know, mostly wealthy people, politicians, people with power or consequence.
Well, traditionally, this is the Democrats' base.
Yeah, yeah, and the media has done a very, very bad job of covering that, of covering. You know, I mean, you've got serious hunger in America. We should, you know, you would think that reporters would want to be covering it. You know, these are
well, it's corporate media. Yeah. You're about the only one. You know.
Yeah, well, I own my own show. Which is increasingly rare, by the way. I was surprised a year or so ago when I discovered that a lot of the big conservative shows are not actually owned by their hosts. They're owned by the company that syndicates them. It's pretty remarkable. But more charts and graphs. I think, Bruce, Democrats also need more bumper sticker slogans. They need to figure out ways to reduce issues down to 2, 3, 4 words, and then create a frame and an anchor to those words, so that when those words are said, immediately it produces a response, not unlike the way that Republicans can say illegal immigrants or welfare queens or, you know, I mean, fill in the blanks. There's a dozen phrases that they can use that will, you know, everybody on their base immediately knows what they're talking about.
That's easier said than done, Tom, because come up with a couple of suggestions. You've thought about it for years. Can you think of a couple offhand?
Yeah, I wrote a book about it. It's called Cracking the Code, back in the last presidential election. I think that there are some. Right to Work for Less, for example. Why don't they beat on that a whole lot more instead of, you know, just going along with this right to work? That's something that the Democrats should have been doing since 1947. When they first passed Taft-Hartley. Bruce, thanks for the call. We need more charts and graphs, I agree. And we need more slogans. Mostly, though, we need good people in politics, and we need you to vote. We'll be right back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michael in Chicago. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
How's it going?
Good.
I got a question. How do you get away with pleading the fifth and not going to prison when it seems like everybody I know that's ever pleaded the fifth goes to jail?
Yeah. Who's pleading the fifth?
How's that work?
What's the case in point here?
Well, I just don't understand. My case is the governor is able to plead the fifth, and he was able to get away with
it. Oh, he pled the fifth not as a governor. He pled the fifth as the CEO of ACA or whatever it was, whatever the company was called.
I'm sorry. You're correct, yeah.
Yeah.
And then also, who needs Venice when we have South Florida now?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, Venice is adapted to rising waters, but these might be a little faster and a little more violent than Venice has had to deal with. Michael, thanks for the call. Jeff in... And just hang on just a second, Jeff. Apropos of what Michael was talking about, most people don't even know the name of the South Dakota's governor. His name was Mike Rounds, and I believe he's a Republican. And this is getting kind of weird. He apparently authorized a $1 million loan from the state to a company called Northern Beef, and Mr. Benda, Richard Benda, who was a top former cabinet official of his, was going to work for this company, and then this and shortly thereafter, this is from David Neer's post over on Daily Kos. Shortly thereafter, Benda, then the state secretary of tourism, secured an additional $600,000 loan, money that went directly into his own pockets as he paid himself $225,000 a year to oversee the now failed plant. So it's like, you know, Republicans passing money back and forth to their buddies and their friends and all this kind of thing. Is this how we want government to? Oh, and I wanted to finish my Sam Brownback rant, and then I will get to your calls. Sam Brownback, this also over at Daily Coast, Jen Hayden blogging. Sam Brownback said, cutting taxes would bring economic growth, create jobs, and stabilize the budget. Kansas is now reporting more than a $300 million revenue shortfall, and the poverty rate has increased. Brownback has been able to do all this while growing his economy at half the rate of Kansas's neighbors. Right. What's really interesting is that the revenue numbers are even worse. The last 3 months, they just came out, the revenue numbers, and they're even worse than was projected. Revenue is down about 10%. It was a miss by 10%. They were expecting to bring in $578 million. Instead, they brought in $524 million. Now, why were they expecting to bring in no other state has this big a variation. Why were they expecting to bring in $578 million? Well, Sam Brownback and the Republicans in Kansas can't tell you why they expected to bring in that amount of money through any sort of mathematical formula or any sort of evidence-based economic science. They can't do that. What Sam Brownback has been saying, and the Republicans have been saying since 1981, is that if you cut taxes on rich people and corporations, which Kansas did in a big way, that will somehow cause so much prosperity that overall tax collections will go up, overall revenue into the Treasury will go up. And it turns out, not only is that not the case, it's the opposite of reality. When you cut taxes on rich people, pretty much the only consequence of that that comes out of that is that your tax revenue dies. It's why Ronald Reagan tripled the national debt in 8 years. It had never been done before, triple the national debt in 8 years, other than in the middle of World War II. And, you know, it's faith-based economics. And Sam Brownback, I'm in a way just amazed by this. Because Sam Brownback, you know, he was in the Senate for a long time. This guy's been around. He knew Reagan. He had to know. He had to have read David Stockman's book. It was a joke inside the Reagan cabinet that trickled down. You know, it was a joke they were playing on the American people. They were all in on it. We're helping out our buddies. We're helping out the billionaires. We're helping out the oil guys. We're helping out the Saudi princes. We're helping out the rich people. Screw the working people. Reagan doubled the payroll tax on working people, on people who at that time made less than $40,000. He doubled it. And then he cut the tax on rich people by almost two-thirds. And they sat around and laughed about it. So Sam Brownback then becomes governor of Kansas. And you would think he knew that this is something you feed the people. This is the PR you feed them. But you don't actually do it. Or at least if you do it, you don't do it in a way that is obvious how bad it's going to work. So Kansas has now become, it's a basket case for Kansas because of Reaganomics, modern-day Reaganomics.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, 34 years of pretty continuous Reaganomics hasn't helped. Jobs are vanishing everywhere, but Kansas, boy, that's a problem. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just look at these numbers. This is revenue numbers from July through September, the first 3 months of fiscal year 2015, suggest Kansas' revenue gap is permanent, not temporary, because of these tax changes that Sam Brownback made. Kansas's wide miss was probably a result of wading into uncharted territory with its tax reforms. In addition to cutting income tax rates, Kansas made itself the only state with a general personal income tax that exempts pass-through income from tax. Income that rich people earn, basically. It's just remarkable. This is a story that everybody in America should know. not just people in Kansas. When you try Reaganomics, we tried Reaganomics at the national level. We've been doing it for 34 years now. And what has it done? It's destroyed the middle class. You got $1.2 trillion in student loan debt, something that no other developed country in the world has. I mean, Germany just outlawed college tuition. All college is free in Germany now. We're going the exact opposite direction these last 34 years. And back before Reagan, I mean, I went to college back in the late 60s, early 70s. I didn't know anybody who had student loans. Actually, I had one friend who had student loans. He was working on his master's degree in mathematics. Graduate school was what you got a student loan for. It's really, really a tragedy that it's taken us this many years to figure out what a lie Reaganomics was. And then I guess we should thank Sam Brownback because he just came right out and said, hey, I believe in this stuff. Or he said, I'm going to take my 4 years as a governor and I'm going to transfer hundreds of millions of dollars to my rich buddies who will then hire me when I leave the governor's office for a very, very princely sum, if anything, you know, if past is prologue. We'll see. But either he really believed it or he really just wanted to shovel a bunch of money to some people and leave his state screwed and then move back to Washington, D.C. when he's done. I don't know. I don't know what's in Sam Brownback's heart. I don't whether he was, you know, a useful idiot for the billionaires in Kansas. Koch brothers live in Wichita, don't they? Isn't Koch Industries based out of Wichita? And that's Kansas, isn't it? I think so. Might have something to do with it. Hey, Sam, thank you for lowering the taxes on the Koch brothers. I'm sure that they appreciate it. But not so much your state. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Well, actually, one of your callers, I was calling about political consultants, how not to listen to, but one of your callers.
Jeff?
Break talked about creating pictures and graphs and so forth.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Well, I see the Denver, what I call the Fradycrats, they just don't seem to get it. I mean, we're three-brain beings. You know, Gurdjieff speaks of this, where we have emotional, intellectual, and moving centers. We don't learn unless we use two of those centers, and so we need to tell stories because the emotional center sees in pictures.
Right.
The Dems knew how to tell stories in the 60s, as did Reagan. Look at, we had the Peace Corps, we had Head Start, and look at you.
See that?
Picture in your mind of being somewhere in Africa helping people. But the Dems in the 2000s, when they improved childhood health insurance, they called it S-CHIP.
Yeah, I know.
It's no picture. It has no meaning to anybody.
Well, it creates a picture in my mind of cow patties.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you avoid when you're walking through a field. Look, don't step in that S-CHIP.
You have to bring in the moving center, the emotional center. We had We Shall Overcome, the songs of the different movements. We learned our ABCs by singing.
Yeah.
You know, when you learn the biblical stories, the Greek mythology, you saw the pictures. Well, Reagan knew how to do that. The Dems in the 60s did.
Yeah.
And also, you can play off well-known phrases like right now. I mean, it's a Republican stupid is what we should be saying all the time. Yeah. Or play verbal Aikido, so like use our own phrase against them. So when Bush said, had his education thing, we should call it No Child Left of Mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that it's every time you hear it, you hear also the opposite thing.
Bush's thing was really no testing company left behind. And it coincided with Neil Bush going into the testing company business.
Yeah, but as far as the Fradycrats are concerned, you really need to ignore the political consultants. You need to be a progressive, not a product.
Yeah.
You know, with the radio people, I know radio fairly well.
Yeah.
And I see them doing this, but also like in the 80s, most beer is bland. And we did what I called Budweiser marketing, where you create a product to offend as few people as possible.
Right.
But then the microbrewers came along and they made, so you're always basing your product on the negative. If it bothers somebody, make it more mellow.
Right.
But the microbrewers came along and made a great product. And all of a sudden, all the big, the microbrewers are taking over.
Yeah.
That's what we need to do with politicians. I mean, Gore, and if you listen to him on shows like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, he's brilliant. He's funny, quick, But in 2000, he was a dull, milquetoast product.
Yeah. Because he was following the Bob Shrum school of campaigning.
I mean, it was not the same person you hear on these. You hear Gore off the cuff. He's great.
Yeah.
But then when you stand for something, if you look at the guy who beat Eric Cantor,
mm-hmm.
he really stood for something, although I don't agree with it. But he was outspent by more than 40-1, yet he beat Cantor by 10 points.
Yeah,
you got to stand for something. You got to tell stories.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And there's an interesting piece in today's Washington Post about how Alison Lundgren Grimes wants the Democratic Party, at least the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which I think Chuck Schumer runs. I could be wrong. But anyhow, the DSC, whatever it is, pulled the money for her advertising. And so she basically started holding press conferences and started speaking her mind and started saying things that, you know, were not cautious. And all of a sudden she bumped back up in the polls. This has all happened like in the last 2 days, bumped back up in the polls. And the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee says, well, maybe we have a chance here. And they just put, you know, a couple $100,000 back into the campaign in Kentucky. So, you know, I absolutely agree with you, Jeff. And I think the number one, Democrats running for President Obama is a big mistake. I think they should be running with him, and they should be. And I mean, he's done a very poor job, or at least his administration has done a very poor job of messaging their accomplishments. But his surrogates should be doing that. And Bill Clinton, at least, was very good at getting his surrogates to dance to his tune. And the surrogates, you know, these politicians who are running away from the president, who are running away from Obamacare, they're shooting themselves in the foot. They just absolutely are. Jeff, spot on. So right. Dan in Moscow, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dan, what's up?
I'd like to ask you, you being a progressive pundit, about NPR had a bunch of articles about the millennium, the people generation born between 1980 and 2000,
mm-hmm.
and how they were had a high percentage of being Democrats and being progressive. And I'm wondering if this is like hope for the future. Of course, they don't vote in midterm elections, but I think maybe the future of the Democratic Party might be brighter than it is today.
Oh, I think so, and also the demographic shifts. You know, as the Republican Party increasingly becomes the party of old white men, and you know, outspokenly, we're seeing that the United States is getting younger, it's getting browner, and you know, that's good news for the Democratic Party, which is a more inclusive party, and is, you know, so, you know, we'll see where this goes, Dan.
I think we need to look. I just want to find some optimism because of the upcoming
This is why the Republicans are doing voter suppression in 20 some odd states, is because they know that if everybody has an opportunity to vote, they're going to lose. So they've got to cut out part of the electorate. And, you know, it's an ongoing pride. It's something they've been doing for a long, long time, and they're going to do more and more of it. Dan, thanks for the call. Jim in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, I'm just going to present a pretty abstract idea. Very difficult to do this, but I'm going to try anyway. I hear a conversation on liberal talk radio about how weak the Democrats are, how they have no backbone, how they can't stand up to Republicans. And I just want to say that if looking at it from Karl Rove's Machiavellian mind, this is exactly what he wants.
Oh, I know. I know. And that's why I generally don't have that conversation. That was Mike Papatoni who said that, not me. What I'm saying and will continue to say is that Democrats need to speak out and be more progressive, as I just said.
It's the conversation with your listeners that I keep hearing that I'm talking to. And I'm saying that they don't really get how Machiavellian, how manipulative. When you have hundreds of millions of dollars to do this with, right. It's very, very.
Yeah, the number one message that Karl Rove wants people to get is, you know, the election doesn't matter that much, and it's not that big a deal. And in fact, I mean, Fox News is telling young women, single women, don't even bother voting. You know, there's nothing in this for you. And the Democrats, they're not that great. You know, it's only kind of a half-ass party, so why bother voting? And then they turn around, you know, look at what people do, not what they say. Then they turn around and spend hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in some cases, to get their folks elected. So they know that elections matter. They know that elections are very consequential. Koch brothers wouldn't be spending hundreds of millions of dollars of their own money if they didn't know that elections are insanely important. So, yeah, I'm with you. Jim, thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour. Congresswoman Barbara Lee is going to be with us shortly. Hopefully. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in a couple of minutes, we're going to check in with Bob Ney over at the Talk Radio News Service to find out what's going on in the world. Welcome back. Keith in Landrum, South Carolina, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I watched your Lone Liberal segment last night on RT, and it's all I could do to keep from throwing shoes at my TV.
Sorry about that.
Number one, $7.50 an hour is not minimum wage. It's above minimum wage, and those numbers don't show up. Food stamps and welfare pays maybe 25% of what your actual salary is. So how they think that, oh, these are all welfare queens is beyond me. But the one that I love is when people say, oh, raising the minimum wage will lose jobs. And I tell my Republican friends, I says, oh, okay, but by that logic, if we lower the minimum wage, we'll increase jobs. And they run away like cockroaches when you turn on the light.
I think the people I was debating last night would say, yeah, lower the minimum wage and you'll increase jobs. And in fact, you're seeing now this libertarian strain of economic philosophy starting to metastasize through the Republican Party, and an increasing number of Republicans coming out, Chris Christie day before yesterday, and basically saying, we don't even need a minimum wage. You know, let's do away with the minimum wage.
Well, I know, but $10.10 an hour at Walmart would raise prices $60 for every $1,000 purchase. That is a small price to pay for a higher wage.
Well, and that assumes that they don't absorb that increased wage by simply lowering their dividends.
Well, who do we know? And relating to your interview with the mayor in South Florida, isn't that another form of gerrymandering?
What?
By dividing the states into demographics and...
Well, that was my point. It would be gerrymandering for the Senate, basically, because the United States Senate, in the United States Senate, you've got a number of senators who represent states with a population of under 3 or 4 million people. Who,
I was wondering about that too, because California wants to break up into 6 different states.
Yeah, I know.
So
I support that.
I said it's something to ponder.
Yeah, it really is. The Senate is not representative of the United States, and I forget the exact numbers, but it's something like there's a group of 20 some odd senators who represent. Fewer than, as my recollection is, it's fewer than 18 million people, which would be, I mean, we have 30 plus million people in the United States, so it's very few people. And those senators are enough to swing the Senate, basically. And, you know, they represent fewer people than California and New York. And
well, I favor doing away with electing the senators and go back to the way it used to be.
Where individual states could simply, senators could buy their way into office?
No, just appoint the senators by the governor. That's the way it used to be.
Right, but the rich people used to give the governor lots and lots of money, and then he would put them into the Senate.
Well, there's other problems with that too. So.
Yeah, I mean that's why we actually amended the Constitution, was because there was so much graft, there was so much corruption in where's the Anaconda copper mine? What state is that? Is that Montana or wherever it was? Colorado, Montana, the Copper Kings. Yeah, there was a guy who famously in the state capitol stood in the back of the room saying, I've got envelopes filled with 10 $1,000 bills each, and anybody who votes for me to be the senator, because at that time it was not just the governor appointing, but the state senate had to elect. And he said, anybody who votes for me, you know, and he handed them these envelopes as they were walking out after they get put it in. Keith, thanks for the call. 10 minutes before the hour, let's check in with Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com, and free-don.org. And Congressman Bob Ney, what's going on in the world today, sir?
Hi, Tom. Well, we're now starting to find out that Michael Zihoff Bibiu, is what he had changed his name to, the shooter, had some ties to some other people in the jihadist movement, one of which he had ties to had left and went to Syria. So they're starting to see that this is maybe just more than somebody that had maybe some form of a mental situation, a mental illness, but maybe had some ties. So there's still a lot of information not out there yet. I think some disturbing news on the issue in general, though, you know, as our president tries to show support for Canada, which is, you know, critical for the two countries, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich took President Obama to task and said he was delusional in his response to the Ottawa shooting, and that's coming from Newt Gingrich. And the interesting part of that, if you actually read what the president said, he had talked to the prime minister, you know, of Canada, and the president said at that point in time, because there wasn't enough information yet, even from the, you know, the Canadian side, you know, we had to be in sync with them, and the president said it emphasizes the degree to which we have to remain vigilant when it comes to dealing with these kinds of acts of senseless violence or terrorism. And the White House has made it clear after the facts came in and the Canadians recognized, you know, that in calling the terrorists, then, you know, we went into agreement. But the story itself, you know, in the blogosphere, the headlines and some of the reports as I was sorting the news, Tom, to do your show, is, you know, President not in sync with Canada, our headlines. And that is just...
Sounds like Drudge.
Far from the truth.
That's kind of stuff Drudge does. I mean, that's...
Yeah, and this is, you know, and so... we are, you know, reaching out to Canada and trying to do everything we can do intelligence-wise. Tom, another story that's going to be fascinating to see if the Congress responds with as much zeal as it did on the previous IRS issues. There's a 10-year veteran of the Internal Revenue Service, and this attorney has demanded that there be a congressional audit of the IRS, and that's what he's demanding. And he is making some fascinating allegations. And what he is saying, that he has, you know, sent this in letters to the IRS itself, that the IRS, top of the food chain, the top executives of the IRS, were actually, in fact, giving tax breaks, huge tax breaks to corporations. And they named specifically, you know, the situations where they were giving the actual breaks to them. In one case, the IRS was auditing a U.S. company that had fraudulently underreported its profits by $3 billion annually. So this company, a U.S. company, fraudulently reported, you know, $3 billion annually less. Now, on behalf of the IRS, this whistleblower drafted a detailed report, proved the fraud to the agency, but the agency closed its audit with ever asking a question or reviewing the documents submitted. As much as $4 billion in taxes were lost in just that one case alone.
Wow.
And then there's a second case involving $6 billion in taxes, which was due to, according to the IRS criminal investigation agents, it was inexplicably shut down, absolutely no reason. Instead, detailed evidence of fraud and malfeasance in hundreds of thousands of specific accounts was ignored. And then there's a third case. So I think that, I don't know if they're going to pursue this again with the same zeal that they did with the other IRS, but right alone, if you total these up, there's probably about 12-some billion dollars. And again, the direct allegation is that the IRS participated with these corporations to cover
up. Now, Bob, is this IRS employees who are looking to feather their own nest by preparing job opportunities for them in the future at these companies? Do we have any idea what their motivation was?
Well, some people do feel that, and that hasn't come out yet in the report. But the fact that, you know, it's not like philosophically they just feel that, you know, these corporations needed a break, but maybe they're doing something to, again, help themselves because of the revolving door.
Right.
And you know, if you look at the 2010, the former IRS chief counsel, Donald Korb, was a George Bush appointee, and he criticized the creation of the whistleblower office under his tenure as a real disaster for the tax system.
Hmm.
And that was, of course, because people were going through this revolving door. So there's no question that these top people in the IRS, as this proceeds on, there's no question they didn't just do this because they sort of felt philosophically they needed to do it for the right cause. But that whole revolving door aspect, you know, is something that's absolutely out there. I just think it's a fascinating story. When you want to talk about, you know, the past issues of looking at conservative and liberal groups, this is an issue where directly seems like they have proof that there were absolute deals cut.
Any evidence that Darrell Issa is all over this, or is this?
Well, I was going to say right now he's not. Doesn't seem to be pursuing this, and it's a huge story. It's just not a small story. This, they have just three examples alone here, you know, of some pretty bad situations where these corporations, with the knowledge of people within the IRS, just got away with billions and billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's something to watch. I don't know if Congressman Issa will pursue it, but I would imagine a letter has been sent, by the way, to Senator Sanders.
Good.
And I would say that Senator Sanders, of course, is going to...
Bernie will have something to say about that.
I would think he would. And the House should, by all nature, although it won't, most likely, should pursue this. You know, if the Republicans don't want to waste taxpayers' dollars and want to balance that budget, here's a little way to do it.
Yep.
Pick up some money.
There you go.
They say the ultimate cost to America was $25 billion on this.
Wow.
On these cases. And then Blackwater guards are convicted, of course, is a big story with the Iraq massacre, which goes back to the whole issue of why on earth we privately contracted in the first place.
Right. Were these guys, they were convicted in criminal court alone, right, as individuals, as opposed to Blackwater itself bearing any culpability. Do I have that right?
Yes, and these were individual cases, one manslaughter, one murder. But, you know, the corporation itself, as a corporation...
It's getting off scot-free.
Yes.
Amazing. Amazing. Congressman Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped. Congressman, thank you so much for dropping by. Always good talking to you. We'll be back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And there's a real problem in the United States, a very serious problem in the United States that has to do with a lack of understanding. And I want to try to just remedy this very quickly. A lack of understanding on the part of the American people as a consequence of 34 years of Reaganomics propaganda about how economies work. The thing that drives an economy is something that economists refer to as aggregate demand. Now, you can find documentation of this, arguably, all the way back to Aristotle. And, you know, I mean, this has been well understood for thousands, literally thousands of years. Adam Smith wrote about this in A Theory of Moral Sentiments and touched on it in Wealth of Nations. David Ricardo, that was 1776, 1807, David Ricardo writing about it on labor. John Maynard Keynes in his numerous books, but his, you know, general theory of economics. And you know, right up to today, but an aggregate demand is the amount of money that people have to spend and actually do spend, right? Not just what they have that they could spend, but what they actually do spend or are willing to spend. So aggregate demand, demand which is what drives economies, comes out of what? Wages. The thing that drives an economy is wages, because if people make money, they spend that money. In addition to wages driving demand, pretty much anything that generates economic activity that is of a consumption variety, that causes people to buy things, also stimulates an economy. So, for example, one of the most effective stimulus programs for an economy, food stamps. You spend a dollar on food stamps, you make $1.30 in economic activity. Long-term unemployment benefits. Spend $1 million in long-term unemployment benefits, you make $1.5 million in the economy. And arguably a lot more, because money circulates through an economy multiple times. The problem that we have, of course, is that our trade policies are such. It used to be that somebody would get a wage, they would get their paycheck, then they would go to the store and they would buy something that was, you know, they'd go buy a pair of socks. And that pair of socks came from a mill down the street in South Carolina here. And the mill then hired people to make the socks and it paid those people a salary. And those people then took their paychecks and they went out and they bought stuff. And so it just, you know, it's called a virtuous cycle. That virtuous cycle got broken with one of the principal tenets of Reaganomics, which is that protectionist trade policies are not a good idea. And so, you know, since the 80s, we have been increasingly, and this is ongoing. I mean, this dimension of Reaganomics is being advocated right now, even by this administration to some extent with TPP. Although Harry Reid is standing in the middle of the stream here, like a boulder, holding his hand up and saying, stop. And if Harry Reid loses control of the Senate, I predict that you will see Fast Track passed and TPP passed within the next few months. This is one of the really, really bad outcomes of Republicans taking over the Senate. Excuse me. The sales pitch, so demand is what drives an economy. So if the real, quote, job creators, Franklin's phrase that has been used by Republicans to describe rich people, but the real job creators, actual people who are creating jobs, are the people who are spending all of their paycheck or are using their food stamps or are using their long-term unemployment benefits or are, you know, whatever it may be, even if it's government, even if it's the dole, right, whatever it is, if they're spending that money, they're stimulating the economy. So what have Republicans done over the last 6 years since President Obama's been in the White House? They have cut long-term unemployment benefits last Christmas. I mean, I thought, this is so heartless, I can't imagine that they're going to do this and get away with it. But they did. They cut long-term unemployment benefits, and now 3 or 4 million people have lost their unemployment benefits because the Republicans filibustered the legislation as it came to the Senate. And why would they do that? Well, the simple answer is they would do that because it's going to make the economy worse. Why would Republicans make the economy worse? So they can brag about it. Tune into any right-wing talk show. Watch Fox News. Listen to the conservative pundits who come on this program. They sit around going, oh, look at the unemployment rate is really even worse than you think it is. They're bragging. Wages are going down. Been going down for 30. They're bragging. Average person is getting screwed. People can't afford their homes. They're bragging. Kids are in debt like they've never been. They're bragging. This is Republicans bragging. And their plan for the next 2 years, particularly if they get control of the Senate, their plan for the next 2 years is to take this country down economically. Because economics always beats, the only thing that can beat economics in an election is war. So if they can make the economy bad enough, if they can do to President Obama what the Arab oil boycott did to President Carter, and the economy, frankly, was not all that bad under Carter. It was doing quite well. It's just inflation got up there a bit as a consequence of the oil boycott. But the net of it is that the Republicans, you know, they've made all this grand hoo-ha about it, and inflation actually peaked during the Reagan administration, but still, people don't tend to remember that. Carter got blamed for it. So they're trying to Jimmy Carterize Barack Obama. And they don't care who gets hurt. They don't care who loses their job. They don't care who's losing their home. They don't care whose marriage is breaking up. They don't care who's committing suicide. Yes, suicides are up. As the BBC documented, over a 100-year period in England, when conservatives were in control, suicides went up. When liberals were in control, or labor, they call it in the UK, suicides went down. Republicans don't care. Like they were saying last night on my TV show, hey, you know, let people work for 50 cents an hour. And don't even pay them with money. Pay them with food. If you're going to, this is actually what John Kasich is proposing in Ohio. If you want food stamps, if you want to get $2 or $3 a day worth of food stamps, you have to work 4 hours a day. Picking up trash by the side of the road, cleaning out waste from a hospital, whatever it may be, free, unpaid. Or prove that you have spent that 20 hours that week pounding the pavement, knocking on the doors of employers. 50 cents an hour. Talk about minimum wage. This is, you know, John Kasich in Ohio wants that to be the new minimum wage in Ohio. And we'll pay you with food. I mean, that's how bizarre it is.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So when you get it that demand is what drives economies, you get it that if you want to increase, if you want to strengthen the economy, you increase wages at the bottom end of the wage scale. And welcome back, Dick in Vita, Oregon. Hey, Dick, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Well, good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Anyway, about a year and a half ago, saw a letter in the local paper about Vantage, and this guy said he was paying $1,000 a month, and I said, whoa, I know what I'm paying. Since I,
are you talking about health insurance?
Yeah,
okay.
Our Vantage.
I don't know what that is.
Plan.
Oh, you're talking about the name of your health insurance plan. Okay, got it.
Yeah. Anyway, so I called Peter DeFazio's office, and I said, what is this? And she said, I'll get back to you. I really have no idea. She called me a couple days later and said, the government pays the insurance companies on the Vantage plan or Plan C, whatever you want to call it, $600 to $800 a month per person on Medicare Vantage plan. And depending on your age, your medical history, and the place where you are. And I said, whoa, that's a heck of a lot of money.
Right.
It's a subsidy to insurance companies.
Right.
We need to get back the Medicare single-payer period.
Yeah. Well, the Republicans have drilled all these holes in Medicare to create an opening for private corporations, principally United Healthcare, which is the largest of the Medicare providers, the Medicare Advantage providers. And, you know, it sounds all wonderful, Medicare Advantage, but really what it is privatized. They've taken a slice of Medicare and privatized it. I had no idea that the subsidies that were being paid to these health insurance companies were anywhere near that large. I'm skeptical of that number, but it's...
I am not. I was amazed, and I said, are you sure, when she called me? And she said, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when I heard that, I was amazed. Per month, $600 to $800 in Lane County.
Yeah.
Depending on who you are.
Yeah.
And what your medical history is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Like I said, I've not heard that. But, you know, this was Congressman DeFazio's office. We have a good relationship with Congressman DeFazio. We should call him up and ask him, see what the story is. So,
and the
And one comment.
Sure.
I've been around a few years since 1929.
Wow.
And my Republican friends have two things in their mind. Welfare and taxes.
Right.
That's all they can think about.
Yeah.
They could care less about anybody else.
They don't want their taxes to go up, and they don't want their tax money to go to poor people.
And the facts are that people that are receiving welfare is a very minimal compared to the whole United States.
Yeah.
And the other thing, it's mostly majority white.
Yeah. Yeah. Most people in poverty are either children or elderly or disabled. And you're absolutely right, Dick. I mean, it's severe poverty to the point where they're getting government assistance. Dick, thank you very much for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Place Where Despair is Not an Option. Sally Alice Thompson in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Is this the woman walking across the country to get money out of politics?
I'm trying to find a place where I can hear.
Sally Alice Thompson?
Yes, that's me.
Hello, Sally Alice. So how is your walk coming?
It's going fine. I'm ahead of schedule.
Uh-huh.
So I think I'll just take a day off.
Uh-huh. That's great. And you just had your 91st birthday, didn't you?
I had my 91st birthday, yes.
Congratulations.
I was on the walk.
Uh-huh. That is marvelous.
So, I have six people walking with me today from Albuquerque. Nobody from Santa Fe has joined us yet.
Uh-huh.
But tomorrow I'm going to take a day off, and then Saturday I'll finish up and end up at the what we call a roundhouse,
uh-huh.
which is the Capitol building.
Well, that's marvelous. That's marvelous. And is there a website where people can help out and find out what's going on?
There's a Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
It's Sally-Alice-Thompson, Get the Mop. Mm-hmm. And the mop is Money Out of Politics.
Okay. That's great. Well, Sally Alice, I thank you so much for calling in. I wish you the very, very best and encourage people to get over to your Facebook page and support what you're doing. Sally Alice Thompson with the mop, 91 years old and marching across the United States for campaign finance reform. Good on you. Get money out of politics. Thank you, Sally Alice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for calling in. Mike in Fort Collins, Colorado. You wanted to speak about Brownback, Colorado, and Florida secession?
Well, no. Well, you were talking about Florida secession. You know, they tried to do that here.
Right.
And, you know, the Northeast counties were whining because Denver wasn't listening to them. They felt. But, you know, my thing on that is they really didn't think it through. If they think that they want to just to walk away with you know my square yard of pavement, let's say highway 87 that goes from Denver to up to Cheyenne, you're nuts. And you know my government buildings, et cetera, they did not really think this through, and they don't have the money to pay the rest of us for the assets that they're going to take. As far as Brownback and Kansas goes, I am a native Kansan, and I watch things that go on in Kansas very closely. And yeah, that's terrible what they're doing to the finances. It's you know everybody's going to say, oh, you know, it's great that you know Sam gave me a tax cut. Yeah, hooray for Sam. And the thing that I fear is that Brownback and Robertson. And I believe the guy who's the Secretary of State are all going to get reelected because I don't think the voters in Kansas are smart enough to figure out that they're having it shoved where the sun don't shine.
Mm. Yeah, it's It's amazing. I mean, I think the only reason why Brownback back may even get reelected is because he's saying, I lowered your taxes, and ends the sentence there, not I lowered your taxes and ruined your state. And
right.
You know, this is the it's tragic, but it's the Republican way. Mike, thanks for the call. Carol in Woodhaven, New York. Hey, Carol, what's up? Carol, you are on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. You know, I just wanted to get back to something about President Obama and some of the things that have been said or, you know, intimated about his leadership and what have you. And I want to go all the way back to when he was first elected. And a lot of people try to compare his leadership to presidents of the past and, you know, FDR, some of the other wonderful leaders that we've had. And early on, before I knew for certain that there was this cabal on the night of the election with the Republicans to just destroy everything he touched.
You're talking about the Obama.
Early on,
right.
Yeah. Early on, I knew this. I knew this because, I don't know, I think people of color who have had to go through this are just more acutely aware of what people will do.
Yep.
And, you know, and I knew this, and I kept telling people, this is not just some ragtag group of people that are doing this. This is deliberate. It's conscious. It's targeted. And I knew kind of early on that we couldn't. It's not that we couldn't critique him, because he really kind of asked for us to say, if I'm doing something wrong,
yeah,
you know, do it, you know. Tell me, fight against it, do what you have to do.
Yeah.
I just knew early on that you couldn't keep him in the same context as you did other presidents before him, because other presidents before him did not have, you know, because we only had the Congress and the Senate for what it was, 73 days,
yeah.
You know, that he could have had a complete majority.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that, and yet, this has been something that I just don't see people from the very beginning even trying to stress that this guy.
No, I'm completely with you, Carol. Your phone is breaking up badly, and it's every time you say a word, it goes shh, and so I've got it. But thank you for the call. You're right, and this was the. You're right. It wasn't a ragtag band. This was the elite of the Republican Party who met the night that Barack Obama was first inaugurated to destroy his presidency. Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jim DeMint, John Kyle.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jeb Henserling, Pete Sessions. Did I say Pete Sessions? Yeah. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Congresswoman Barbara Lee, one of the most effective, brilliant, thoughtful, insightful members of the United States House of Representatives, one of my heroes, is on the line with us. Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Tom, and thank you for that kind introduction.
It's always a pleasure talking with you. Congresswoman Lee represents the 13th District of California. I'd like to talk about Ebola and the CDC funding cuts and the Republicans, getting all upset about czars and then B, calling for czars and then C, for what, a year and a half now, filibustering a Surgeon General. What's going on with all this stuff?
Well, you know, they're politicizing this, and it should not be politicized.
Right.
Can you hear me, Tom?
I hear you just fine. Yeah.
You know, 16% of CDC's funding was cut. More than 10% of National Institute for Health funding was cut. 44% of funding for federal hospital preparedness program was cut. I'm on the Appropriations Committee, the subcommittee that funds all of our domestic and global health programs. And I'm very concerned about the funding cuts because, of course, you know, cuts to NIH, CDC, and hospital preparedness all are vital to our ability. These cuts will hamper our ability, and the programs are vital to our ability to address global health crises. And, you know, we don't have a Surgeon General. This is outrageous, a year and a half. So some of us have written to, you know, the Senate to, that we should get this moving and get a Surgeon General. And I think that's extremely important that we have one person, a Surgeon General, not only to address Ebola, but all diseases and all health care issues. Fortunately, and yes, I am pleased the President did appoint an Ebola czar, because we need someone who has a background who can manage the agencies and the process, because we, as you can see, are moving in the right direction to be sure that our country and Americans are protected. And we have to do more in the countries of Africa to stop this disease from, you know, killing Africans and, you know, taking away, destroying fragile healthcare systems that in many ways are not existent anymore, and to keep the disease from coming, you know, from being transmitted into our own country.
Right, right. It's the larger the reservoir, the greater the risk to us. So we've seen these relentless cuts over the years to a lot of these budgets. I was talking earlier about how you know, the best ways to stimulate the economy are to extend long-term unemployment benefits, to provide food stamps, to raise the minimum wage. Republicans oppose all those things. You look back at Robert Draper's book about Congress that just came out in paperback with a new title. I think it's called When the Tea Party Came to Town. And he talks about this meeting at the Caucus Room restaurant the night that President Obama was inaugurated, when he was doing the inaugural balls. These guys got together and basically swore to each other that they were going to do everything they could to destroy the Obama presidency and oppose everything. Is your sense of Congress that this gridlock, this opposition is absolutely continuing, and that it's nakedly political, as Robert Draper reports, or that there's still some ideology?
It's absolutely continuing. Actually, it's getting worse. And when you recall Senator Mitch McConnell, now as their leader said, their first priority was not to create jobs and turn the economy around, but their first priority was to make sure that President Obama was a one-term president. They didn't let that happen. President Obama won with a large majority second time around. And what happened was, because they lost, they've been the worst obstructionists ever by just stopping President Obama's agenda straight dead in its track. When you look at raising the minimum wage, when you look at comprehensive immigration reform, when you look at a variety of issues, we have the votes in the House to pass these measures, but Speaker Boehner will not bring them up because they're trying to just stop anything that would be beneficial and to the country and that would help people live the American dream. And, you know, I hope people remember elections are coming up and hold these members of Congress accountable for not doing the job that we were sent here to do.
Well, and in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's always seemed to me that the most important vote that a member of Congress makes is that first vote for leadership. And, you know, whether the House is going to be run by Nancy Pelosi or whether it's going to be run by John Boehner, whether the Senate's going to be run by Mitch McConnell or whether it's going to be run by Harry Reid. And the way that we can influence that vote is by showing up and voting in these midterm elections, you know, for Democrats, it seems.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the efforts all of us are mounting, and we're helping candidates around the country. We've got some phenomenal House candidates, so we can take back the House so Speaker Pelosi will again be Speaker. I'm in Louisiana today. I was in North Carolina. I'll be going to Georgia and Texas working to help Senate candidates and others with get-out-to-vote efforts. It's very important that people in states where there's early voting, that they vote early and that they get people to the polls, because this is a very important election. Lots at stake. The whole issue with regard to voting rights, you know, they've tried every which way to try to take our votes away and try to make it more difficult for us to vote. And I think there's going to be a backlash, and we're really encouraging people to vote early, because we can't let our sacred right to vote go without a fight. And so our fight should be resistance and defiance against what the Supreme Court has done by undermining the Voting Rights Act, for all of these terrible voter ID laws, for all those voter suppression efforts. And so I'm encouraging and urging everyone to vote early and to make sure that they cast their vote for people and for members of Congress, members of the House and Senate, who are going to represent them and hold them accountable. And believe you me, the Tea Party Republicans have not done that. And so we're campaigning very hard for Democrats to take back the House and for Democrats to retain the Senate. Then President Obama will have partners who he can work with in the House and the Senate to accomplish the rest of his agenda.
Yeah, and it may seem like that's Don Quixote on his donkey, you know, going after the windmills. But the reality is that if just a few percent more people were to vote, if we were to get turnout numbers that were like they were 2 years ago in a presidential election for this midterm election, Democrats actually have a good chance of taking back the House and a good chance of holding on to the Senate.
Absolutely. And when we talk about that, we have to break it down. What does that mean when Democrats win? We protect voting rights. We ensure equal pay for women. Of course, when women succeed, America succeeds. We're talking about affordable child care. We're talking about equal pay for equal work. We're talking about paid family medical leave that helps men and women. We're talking about affordable, accessible health care. We're talking about common sense gun safety measures. I mean, what a difference an election makes, Tom. And so it's about electing candidates for an agenda and for a country that represents and serves everyone in our country, not just the 1%.
Yeah, yeah, so well said. Is one of the, you know, for example, long-term unemployment has died in the House because John Boehner will not hold it up for a vote. What about a discharge petition? Is that something that's doable?
We've been working on discharge petitions on a variety of measures, comprehensive immigration reform, raising the minimum wage, you name it. Even Republicans who support those measures won't sign a discharge petition. We need 218 members. We don't have that in the House right now.
And that's because they're afraid of their political leadership?
Yeah, they're bound by Speaker Boehner and their rules of the game, their party, their Tea Party policies of not really working on behalf of their constituents and the American people. And if you tell me raising the minimum wage only helps Democrats and Democratic constituencies, I mean, I don't know, you know, what country people are living in. They're Republicans who are working two jobs.
Yeah, a lot of them. A lot of them.
Living below them.
Yeah. Whoop, we just lost Barbara Lee. Her phone just croaked. But I think she pretty much said what she had to say. So, yeah, we just have 1 minute left. Pete, you might want to call her back and thank her and let her know that, you know, the phone died. I'm guessing she was on her cell phone. But this is actually a very, very consequential election. And in a lot of states, you can vote right now. And, in fact, people are voting right now all over the country. And this is something that we need to be, you know, paying serious attention to.
Barbara,
Congresswoman Lee.
Yeah.
Welcome back.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
We're down to 30 seconds.
Pardon?
I said we're down to 30 seconds until we hit the break here. But please finish your thought.
Okay, I'm sorry. Something happened with the phone. But I just think it's important for people to recognize that we have votes to pass some of these policies that affect the American people in a positive way, and in fact that it not only do they affect Democrats and Democratic constituencies, what we're pushing for and fighting for everyone, for the entire public and for people who are living below the minimum wage, living below the poverty line and working.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a shame and disgrace. So
it really is the richest nation in the world.
Turn out.
Thank you. Hey, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, thank you so much for being with us. We'll be right back.
Good being with you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out our new website, TomHartman.com. You can drop into our chat room. You can have your own blog. You can post on our message boards. Lots of cool stuff there. And welcome back. Deborah in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hey, Deborah, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
I'm actually working on XM, and I'm not from Massachusetts. I am from District 12, the Hunger Games District 12.
Is your name Deborah?
Yes.
Huh.
You always say I'm from Massachusetts.
Oh, really? Okay, our database is screwed up. We're gonna have to have Pete fix that. You're from where?
I am from the heart of Appalachia, District 12.
Okay, in West Virginia?
No, Kentucky.
In Kentucky. Okay, great.
Yes.
Okay.
And I live where life is literally the shortest and very brutal.
Mm.
And yesterday at the end of your show, you said that in areas where the cost of living is less, we should get paid less. I think you were speaking about Social Security with a caller.
No, I was not. I was talking about the minimum wage, and the person who had called had said that they thought that the minimum wage should be calibrated to local costs of living. What I said was, I think that there needs to be a national standard so that nobody is working at a minimum wage that puts them below the poverty line, the national poverty line. So that would be a national minimum wage of at least 10, arguably $12 an hour. And then in those individual states where the cost of living is unusually high, where, for example, if you live in San Francisco, housing is obscenely expensive. Washington, D.C., housing is very expensive. Downtown New York City, parts of Los Angeles. If you live in an area where the cost of living is extraordinarily high, Seattle, then the minimum wage should be even higher in that lower area, in that area. Than in an area where the cost of living is not as high. That's what I said yesterday.
You are wrong. The quality of life here is piteous. We drink your coal slurry and breathe your coal ash so that you can live in a nice, bright, big city with organic food and nice restaurants and theaters and entertainment, and you burn my mountains to do it. And now you want us to accept less. I came back here as a physician. I was born here. I went away. I finished the 27th grade. I came back here, and I got paid less because I worked in a place, according to the medical societies and the insurance companies, where the cost of living was less.
Mm.
Over half of my patients had no money, no insurance. I was close to broke so many times. I had one friend who actually did go broke in practice. We live in poison and squalor. We don't deserve less. We deserve more. And by the way, I assume that the reason for senators, if I remember from civics class, was so that people like us would, so that you couldn't have us be your Yucca Mountain, so that we had the same voice that you do.
I'm listening to you. I'm trying to understand what you just said.
You said you think we should have less senators.
No, I think we should have more senators.
But you think my voice should be the same as your voice as far as senators go?
Well, I don't have any voice with regard to senators. I live in Washington, D.C. I have no senators. But my point was that a senator from a large state right now has a whole lot less power than a senator from a small state. Relative to the number of people that they represent. I don't think that's democratic. Deborah, thank you for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Mike in Wilmington, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's up? Thanks for watching us on Roku.
Yeah, Tom. I just wanted to ask you a question, and then I'm going to hang up and I want to hear what you have to say. This thing that about these people that you had on your TV show yesterday, them saying that they want people to work for food for 4 hours a day,
right.
Won't that take other people's jobs away if they did that. If they have 10,000 people, that would take a lot of people's jobs away. They wouldn't have to rehire. They could lay off or whatever. And thank you for your time. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, you're welcome, Mike. You're absolutely right. If John Kasich is successful in Ohio in having 35,000 people start working 20 hours a week in exchange for $3 a day worth of food stamps, roughly 50 cents an hour, and that work is doing things that the state would otherwise hire people to do, things like cleaning up the highways, then, yeah, what John Kasich is going to do is lay off people who have a paycheck so that people who are working for food at the rate of roughly 50 cents an hour can keep on working for food. It just strikes me as mean-spirited and bizarre. Suresh in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Hey, Suresh.
Hey, hi, Tom. I'm a big fan and been watching you for the past 4 or 5 years.
Well, thank you.
Through your RT channel and through your web, I mean, the free speech TV thing, but I'm going through YouTube anyway. One big question I've been asking. I've lived in India, I lived in Canada now, and in both the countries are similar parliamentary democracies, and we have both upper chamber and lower chamber in the parliament. And in both the cases, like in Canada, the Senate, and in India, the Rajya Sabha is not even half as powerful as the lower house. But in the U.S., it's a different thing. The Senate is more powerful than the House of Representatives. I mean, why is that, and is there any historical reason for it?
Well, the reason for it is that when the to really get this, you can go back and read the Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention and what the debates were. At the time that our country was put together, the United States was put together, there were a couple of functioning republics, democratic republics. Part of the Netherlands was constant, you know, arguably, but really there was nothing. I mean, this was in their minds a blank slate, and they were looking back at Greece and Rome and, you know, the historic republics and saying, how do we do this? There was one contingent within the group of people who were writing the Constitution who very much was concerned about what happened if the rabble, if the average working person who did not own property and, you know, was kind of economically and socially at the bottom of the rung, if they had power, a lot of power. And in that group, these were by and large people referred to as the Federalists. Today we call them Republicans, felt that you really wanted to have an elite in the country who had the power, an economic elite. The rich people basically should be the ones making the decisions, because they were the ones who were the most educated, the most thoughtful, and they had the most at risk. That was the argument that they made. And then there was another group that was represented by people like Thomas Jefferson, who felt that the more we could do to get closer to the average person being the lever of power, the better. And the compromise that they came up with between these two warring factions, essentially, was that the House of Representatives would have some extraordinary power. All legislation has to originate in the House of Representatives. All spending and taxation has to originate in the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives is elected every 2 years. So this is the closest to the people. You can have multiple congressional districts in a single state, multiple representatives, and so that power was given to the House. On the other hand, there were certain powers that were given to the Senate because they felt that this is the stuff that, you know, where the elite would probably shine. Things like who should be an ambassador, who should be a judge, who should be a Supreme Court judge. So these kind of things require confirmation in the Senate, the advice and consent of the Senate. And, you know, they're very consequential things. The House has nothing to say about who's going to be the Supreme Court justice, only the Senate. So and the senators were not originally elected. They were appointed by the states, so which put another layer of elitism into the Senate. So the Senate has always been an elite body. I think that if Jefferson and Madison were around today, they would say, you know, maybe we shouldn't do it exactly this way. And it wasn't until 1861 that John Stuart Mill came along and proposed, in his book on liberty, proposed proportional representation, where if a political party gets 10% of the vote, they get 10% of the seats, which most of the rest of the world has adopted and we have not. So thus, we're stuck with this two-party system. Makes sense, Suresh?
Yeah, makes sense. Thanks. Thanks, Tom. Thanks
okay.
for the information.
Thanks a lot for the call. And this is, by the way, this is still the dynamic that's playing out in the United States, the big conflict in the United States. I mean, the reason that these guys got together the night that Obama was being sworn in to stop him was because he was a populist. He ran on a populist platform. And, oh, my God, we can't, this is, the rabble are going to run the country? We can't have that. And so, you know, destroy the presidency. This is the one of the things that the Republicans are brilliant at doing is accusing other people of doing what they're doing so that other people can't use that accusation against them. For example, elitism. The Republican elite, the wealthy elite, the billionaire class, the big corporations, the lobbyists, they do not want the average person running our government or even playing a significant role in our government. In fact, they don't want the average person voting if they can avoid it. And yet what they talk about are the pointed-head liberals in their academic, you know. See how it works. You know, it's, they're pointing out what they themselves. So anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back tomorrow. Tomorrow's Friday, right? Hey, it's going to be Brunch with Bernie. Senator Sanders will be with us. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Be sure you and your friends get out to vote. Tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.